From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and in this part of the program, why there is corn in your car, the ethanol explosion. In many parts of the country, when you fill up at the pump, the fuel is 10% ethanol, alcohol made from corn. It's in there because of something that the Energy Act of 2005 did and something that it didn't do. What the law did was mandate that refiners increase the ethanol content of gasoline. What it didn't do was indemnify them against lawsuits claiming damage from the commonly used additive, MTBE. So in much of the country, it was out with MTBE and in with ethanol. And big money for ethanol production. Nearly 80 new ethanol plants are currently being built. Some politicians from California to New York protested that their motorists would spend more than necessary on fuel to effect a kind of farm aid. But where corn is grown, or where politicians court votes in corn country, there is a chorus of pro-ethanol voices from President Bush
ethanol is the first and most notable place where we can start,
to Democrats Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama.
I support all kinds of ethanol.
Our proposal would make major headway towards building an entire ethanol infrastructure in this country.
Iowa Democratic Senator Tom Harkin.
We need to rapidly develop technology to produce cellulose-based ethanol.
And Kansas Republican Senator Sam Brownback.
Strong proponent. Anything ethanol, I'm for it.
Of the 140 billion or so gallons of gasoline that we pump every year, overall only about 2 to 3% is ethanol. But that very small share represents the culmination of a very long history in the Farm Belt, a history that we'll hear about in a few minutes. And it represents a huge shift in our corn crop. 20% of it now goes for ethanol fuel. Corn prices are up. That's obviously good news for the farmers who raise corn. As NPR's Christopher Joyce found in Maryland, it also has a big impact on farmers who don't sell their corn for ethanol.
The Delmarva Peninsula lies just inland from the swanky beach hotels along the mid-Atlantic coast. It's green and pool table flat, and its soil has fed Americans for over 300 years. For about 120 of those years, the Hutchison family has farmed here. They've raised soybeans and hogs and even a crop called canaf for making paper.
And these are grain silos.
Right now, corn is the hot crop, and Robert Hutchison's silos are bursting.
It's just full of corn like that, shell corn. It has to be dried down to anywhere between 15% to 30% moisture. And then we start selling out of it January, February, and March. And then we'll empty our tanks by June.
Corn farmers like Hutchison are getting about $4 a bushel. The corn doesn't sit in silos for long at that price. Hutchison says these high corn prices, pushed up in part by the demand for ethanol fuel, have farmers eager to buy seed.
I sell seed corn as part of my other business. Every farmer that I go to is planting additional acres of corn.
Hutchison's a big fan of ethanol, but it also worries him and other farmers in the Delmarva Peninsula. They don't sell much corn to ethanol distilleries. Their most important customers are hog and poultry producers.
They are our number one user of grain. And we need to be concerned about that. We want them to remain viable. But I do think this whole thing is going to have to shake out to a readjustment of prices and uses of grain.
Farmers here are happy to get record prices for corn, but they don't want to alienate the livestock producers who are unhappy about the way ethanol is pushing up corn prices. And if those prices go too high, the livestock growers will switch to some other kind of feed. These kinds of ripple effects could reach far and wide. Pricier corn could mean pricier bacon, pricier cornflakes, pricier beer. And an ethanol boom could have environmental costs, too. Elizabeth Marshall, an energy economist with the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C., notes that corn uses a lot of fertilizer and a lot of herbicides. These can and have damaged rivers, lakes, and especially the Chesapeake Bay along the Delmarva Peninsula. She says if the country wants more ethanol, it should help farmers find friendlier ways to grow corn and other crops.
A lot of people are actively looking for alternative practices, including corn growers, but it's a very risky field. You can't experiment with new technologies year to year and expect to stay in business if you hit a really bad year.
Delmarva farmer Robert Hutchison is already taking that risk, however. Hutchison is growing a new kind of crop for the ethanol market, barley. Now, most barley has a tough seed hull that ethanol distilleries cannot handle. So Hutchison is growing an experimental hullless barley. The hull drops off during harvest. On a bumpy ride out to his test field, Hutchison says his first job is to convince farmers to grow it.
Part of the challenge of doing this ethanol plant is we had to make sure the farmer would get enough additional income producing ethanol out of it, that he would still net out the same or more as he would growing conventional barley.
The idea is that farmers could grow winter barley for the ethanol market and summer corn to keep the chickens and hogs fat and happy. Moreover, barley keeps soil from blowing away in the winter and sucks up excess fertilizer that might otherwise run into local waterways. Hutchison says his hullless barley is a gamble, but the ethanol boom has helped him make more from his corn crop than he has in decades.
It's been since the 70s since I've really been able to say that farming is really profitable, more than you're just barely earning a living and squeaking by.
The challenge, he says, is to find a way to keep feeding the new ethanol market without losing his old customers. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
The ethanol boom has been a long time coming. Bill Kovarik has written a history of alcohol fuel, which he says was a popular lamp fuel as early as 1840. But during the Civil War, alcohol was taxed. The target was whiskey, but alcohol fuel got caught in the crossfire.
And so by taxing industrial alcohol along with beverage alcohol, they basically put a bunch of distilleries out of business in the 1860s and 1870s and opened the door for the Pennsylvania oil boom. So this was, in a way, a subsidy on petroleum.
Which became cheaper than alcohol by comparison, and as it became more abundant, it stayed that way. The Civil War tax wasn't repealed until 1906, when Theodore Roosevelt was president and no friend of the oil industry. In the early 20th century, road tests showed that alcohol was a competitive fuel. As an additive, it boosted the octane of gasoline. Alcohol mixes were used in many countries. Henry Ford called alcohol the fuel of the future. His critics added, and it always will be. Bob Casey works at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan.
Ford said at some point in the future, we'll run out of oil, but before that time, oil will become so expensive that we'll be looking for some alternative. He was 80 years perhaps too early, but he was looking into the future.
So Ford, like other advocates of alcohol fuels, saw this as a benefit to farmers who might also recognize some income from stuff they were otherwise throwing away.
He was constantly looking for ways to bring industry and agriculture closer together.
Charles Kettering of General Motors was also an alcohol booster, but his engineers figured it would take some new process using cellulose to make enough fuel. Just a few years after the crippling tax was removed, prohibition became the law of the land, and the peddler of alcohol motor fuel was maligned as the colleague of moonshiners and bootleggers. And as Bill Kovarik tells it, alcohol was dealt out of the auto fuel business in favor of another additive that boosted octane.
General Motors made a deal with Standard Oil, which is now Exxon, to back away from this vision of a ethanol-fueled, alternative-fueled America, and to go with tetraethyl lead, which was really just the bridge originally to the fuel of the future.
On June 2nd, we will place a new product on the market, which will be an important milestone in motor fuel history. This new motor fuel is a challenge to all gasoline.
In the 1930s, oil companies were advertising how much power their new leaded gasoline packed. There were already complaints of the toxic effects of lead, but alcohol was still on the sidelines, and as new oil fields were being discovered around the world, alcohol looked even more expensive. But during World War II, grain alcohol was mobilized along with the rest of the country.
Another giant new factory to produce synthetic rubber begins to operate somewhere in the United States. Here, butadiene, derived from alcohol and stored in these huge tanks, is converted into synthetic rubber.
Lauren Schmidt, a Nebraska farmer, remembered those synthetic rubber plants many years later. By 1971, he was a state senator, and he introduced a bill to create the Nebraska Ethanol Board.
And the purpose of the bill, as I drafted it, was to encourage the petroleum companies to remove the lead from gasoline and replace it with ethanol to improve the environment, to reduce our demand upon the foreign supplies of petroleum, and to provide a new market for Nebraska-produced commodities.
By the 1980s, with a jump start from politicians and subsidies, motorists in the Farm Belt were filling their tanks with a mix of oil and corn byproducts.
Not a decade from now, not a year from now, but now. Now there's a motor fuel that's better than gasoline. It comes from Gibbs, and they call it Gasol.
Lauren Schmidt's three aims for promoting ethanol are still cited today, but do they really check out? Tetraethyl lead is gone, its successor additive, MTBE, is on the way out, but is it a net environmental gain? Ken Cook of the Environmental Working Group says it's a close call.
It helps us with climate change. We're producing less CO2 from ethanol than with gasoline. It definitely helps us in respect to cleaner air, but it has some environmental drawbacks too. More soil erosion, more runoff from farm fields growing corn for ethanol plants, pretty heavy use of nitrogen fertilizer. And so the environmental issue really is something we have to watch very carefully. We don't want to reach a tipping point economically or environmentally with this technology, and I'm afraid we're growing so fast that we'll reach it before we know it.
Does it reduce America's dependence on foreign oil? John Filmy is chief economist for the American Petroleum Institute. The API speaks for the oil industry, which now welcomes the role of ethanol. Given the federal mandate to use it, it doesn't really have a choice. But of that role, Filmy says this.
It's limited by the size of the corn crop. We've already seen corn prices go up sharply over the past couple years as the amount of ethanol has increased in the fuel supply. So going forward, that's the real key limitation until you have a development of a new technology.
But as for Nebraskan Lauren Schmidt's third aim, to help farmers find a new market for their grain, the benefit, as environmentalist Ken Cook says, is unmistakable.
You really have to talk to farmers selling corn at a higher price, involved in the ethanol industry and getting money that way too, to feel their enthusiasm, Robert. This is the number one hope for their future. They used to be worried about getting the next women's prison located in the county. Now they're excited about the ethanol plant. The political momentum behind it is incredible.
It is heavily subsidized, federally mandated, and wildly popular on the farm. For Henry Ford's Fuel of the future never appeared so near.
And there are more stories about ethanol's pros and cons, including environmental concerns, and a link to Bill Kovarik's history. You'll find that at our website, npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered.